Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We begin the hour with the underworld of organ trafficking. And finally, migrants leave their country in search of safety or a better life. But many are abducted, enslaved, or disappeared, never to be seen again. We dig deeper into the world of migration and the systems and policies that perpetuate many of the inhumane conditions. The World Health Organization estimates that illegal organ traffickers obtain about 7,000 kidneys per year. The victims are often among the poorest people in the world, who either sell organs to get by or are murdered for them. Nancy Shepherd-Hughes joins us. She is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include Commodifying Bodies and Violence in War and Peace, an anthology. We're also joined by award-winning bioethicist Art Kaplan. He is director of the Center for Bioethics at University of Pennsylvania and editor of books, including Smart Mice, Not So Smart People. Nancy Shepherd-Hughes, how prevalent is this? Where are the illegal activities happening, and what more do we know?
Well, we know a lot. The landscape changes year to year because it is an underground economy. It's a shadow economy, and it opens up in one country. Police get alerted, and the people move on, and, they find another place to operate. But there are some places where it's very, very entrenched, and, you know, in this trade in organs, you have what I basically following some of the trafficking literature. You've got donor countries where people are recruited to sell, and you've got recipient countries or areas where people are inclined to need to travel to get a transplant. And then you have facilitating countries, and that's where the operations take place. In some cases, everything happens in one country, in other places within two. So, I mean, where is it? It's in South Asia, it's Southeast Asia, it's in the Middle East, it's in the United States, it's in Latin America. The Philippines, India, Pakistan, Egypt are, you know, places where this has really become quite entrenched. China, but in each place it's somewhat different. You know, China was using executed prisoners. They got in trouble for that. They passed some laws. Now it's moved to living paid donors, and that's not a good option. It's a hard thing to get the world together on in order to police it properly and to make sure that the worst, most egregious brokers and outlaw surgeons are stopped and prevented. But they seem to be very mobile. They seem to be ahead of the police all the time, and they just move from place to place.
I just heard you say outlaw surgeons.
Yeah, they're outlaws because they're willing to break existing laws in the countries where they're operating. Although I understand that the laws are sometimes a bit murky, most countries that do transplants do have pre-existing older laws that say commerce in tissues and organs is illegal, but often the exact standards, the exact penalty for doing this might be vague. In some countries, it's clearly explicit that you can't sell, but it doesn't say anything about can you buy an organ. So, yeah, there are some loopholes. But in general, organs trafficking is, and human trafficking for organs is covered under the UN Convention, what commonly called the Palermo Convention, and certainly by most of the existing regulations within international transplant.
The gentleman that was arrested was running a trafficking ring.
Or Rabbi Rosenbaum.
He had been engaged in this for about 10 years. You had alerted FBI, I think, 7 years before they did anything.
Yeah.
How prevalent is this organ trafficking in the United States?
Well, it takes, in the United States, different forms. Isaac Rosenbaum was linked to a network that was operating globally, but through key brokers, or really criminal businessmen in Israel. So he was part of this very extensive network that moved people around from Israel to Turkey to Moldova to the Ukraine, Romania to Baku and Azerbaijan to the United States, where they operated in Brooklyn and in Philadelphia and in Maryland and in California, in Los Angeles. So that was one particular network, but there are others. Within India, there's a network in which primarily wealthy Indians, especially diasporic Indians living abroad, go back to India and get transplanted. Lots and lots of people in Asia go to the Philippines. The Philippines is a key site for kidney selling and buying. And a lot of people in the sort of Gulf states and in the Middle East go to Egypt. Iraq, before the war, was a major area for buying and selling organs.
Let's bring Art Kaplan in. There are multiple ethical issues that are tied up in this organ trade. One is the need for organs. One is people who are selling them are in dire enough straits that they're willing to sell parts of their bodily integrity. And the confidentiality between physicians and their patients. How do we address these ethical issues?
Well, there is tremendous need, and Nancy's given a rather sad and accurate picture about the extent to which a black market evolves among particularly poor nations and poor countries to meet that need, but it doesn't really meet the need in a systematic way. What you have is countries, they're not getting organs, and we're talking primarily here about kidneys when we're talking about buying and selling things. They don't have organs coming from cadavers, from the dead, as we do in the United States. They don't develop that system. Their incentive to do it is somewhat lessened. If they think locally they can buy an organ or a kidney from a poor person, they don't do it. You find around the world transplant centers winking and nodding, not doing very intensive interviews because of people who come and say, yes, I want to donate my kidney to my good friend. I think her name is Nancy, my good friend. So they're not checking to see whether I actually know Nancy or cousin as I claim. But, you know, good enough, I'm here and let's go. Their orientation of the transplant centers is to get organs to the people who need them. They make money doing that. They save lives doing that. They're not oriented toward the donors or sellers in the case of this black market situation. So they don't have representation. They don't have voices. They tend to be the ones exploited. I don't think this is the solution. And I would add, when you really start looking at the issue of poor people, and some would say, well, you know, they can make some money, they're poor, this is helpful. What we found in a study that I just headed up for the United Nations and the Council of Europe on organ trafficking was that people don't work their way out of poverty by selling a kidney. The most desperate people sell. People have no other options, no work. It's a one-shot deal. They pay off a debt, and they're back in poverty again. If you wanted to say, well, maybe this market does some good for them, it really doesn't bring them any sort of economic benefit or boon. And the middlemen who handle this trade exploit them, rip them off for costs of travel, food, everything you can think of. They're charging these poor souls, so they don't really come out ahead. It's not a situation where they're coming out better than they were because they sold a kidney.
As I understand it, the United States is lagging from some of the other nations in dealing with the issues of the organ trafficking. Nancy, perhaps you can address this first.
To the extent that we have codes of confidentiality between doctors and patients, and there's a reluctance for the hospital nephrologist or the transplant coordinator or the committee that's in charge of really seeing that the law, NOTA, which our law against buying and selling organs, is being followed. And so the questioning is minimalist. And when I've found hospitals where there has been some consensual buying and selling where people find each other online, but also in New York City when Isaac Rosenbaum was working and some of his associates in the Philadelphia area, they actually did bring in people who were trafficked. They may have initially agreed, but they got to the States and they wanted to get out. And I had a person from Isaac Rosenbaum's network call me and say, I need to get out of this because we're forcing people to do this. I don't mind if people want to buy and sell, but we've had people coming from poor countries. We have Ukrainians, Moldovans, poor Israelis that are coming here. They're getting frightened and they're being told that they have to get up on a table and sell. Now, the fact that the hospitals failed to catch that can only be that there was really a lack of due diligence. If people can't speak the same language, if they seem frightened of each other, if there seems to be a hesitancy. Well, I can tell you that in Europe, I spoke at the House of Lords with a group of very informed experts about how you really regulate this. And in the UK, they said, we have no problem with investigating. And we don't say, oh, we're policing, or we don't say, oh, we become, you know, immigration offices. Basically, if somebody says they're related, we say, oh, well, show us some proof that you're related. So they really do ask for proof, and I've never run into a medical center in the United States where that is customary. I don't know, maybe Art has found that.
Very few, unfortunately, and it's the most simple thing. You'd think they'd want to establish
right
identity, and very few do. Very few. And again, it's partly because I think they are oriented towards saying, let's get the kidney for the people that need them, and we can make money if we put them in. We need kidneys. We got a lot of capacity to do operations. It's very lucrative. Yeah. We're not oriented, I'm talking for the transplant team now, toward detection of donor benefit and interest.
Thank you so much. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
With us is Camilo Mora, professor of geography at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Professor Mora and his colleagues have calculated how climate change will affect our temperatures around the year 2047. In the future, they found, our coldest year will be warmer than the past's hottest years. The changes, which will first occur in the tropics, are already driving some 25,000 species to extinction each year. Here's what Professor Mora had to say.
There is a massive heat wave in India where people is dying from this heat wave. The temperature is just exceeding what most people can tolerate. Now we can go somewhere else around the world. You know, right now in Colombia, last year alone, there was a massive drought there in which 6 months didn't rain at all. This is something that we're not used to. My grandfather and I had never seen something like this. And of course, what happened was then that the animals start dying because there was just no sufficient water for them. We have situations happening in Africa. You go to Africa, you see people close to die of starvation. Most social scientists will tell you that this is a problem of the redistribution of money around the world. But what I can tell you right now is that these people were used to live on those places sustainably. Right now, their environments are so impacted that they cannot provide the minimum resources to support that people. That's why you have so many people in Africa right now starving to death. Of course, if they were to have help from the developed world, that would be fantastic. But basically, those ecosystems have been impaired in the capacity to produce what these people need. And those are just some of the few examples that you can point out around the world where climate change is already becoming evident. And according to the analysis that we published last year, this will start happening very soon, and most places will be added to these events of very extreme climate conditions.
After we move from the tropics, other areas will start to be affected. It's all interconnected. Where do you see it moving next?
One of the things that will happen is that, of course, it's getting warmer on the tropics, and now suitable temperatures will start happening at mid-latitudes, and you will probably start seeing some migrations of species towards more suitable habitats at higher latitudes, again, just because the conditions there will become suitable for them. Many species, unfortunately, especially species that live on islands like here in Hawaii or there in New Zealand, these species will not have the chance of moving. So those species will have to try to adapt to the new conditions, to the new climates. Unfortunately, these changes are happening just too fast for them, and these species have never seen changes like this. So it's very likely that most species just will not have the capacity to adapt to these changes, which will leave a third option for them, which is to go extinct. Entire ecosystems like coral reefs, for instance, could be completely transformed because many species there will not be able to withstand the higher temperatures that we are already seeing, actually. So that's what will happen in mid-latitudes. So some species will start moving towards there, but there is going to be a point in which you are going to run out of space, really, where you can find suitable climates. Again, in the paper that we published last year, we found that the average location on the whole planet will have completely new temperatures by the middle of this century. By around 2050, the average location on this planet will have conditions that we have never seen in the last 200 years.
There was a New York Times article in which you were cited, and they talked about your report, or about your paper that was published in Nature. And there were certain areas that people would need to move toward for livability. It sounded like the Canadian zone would be okay. It sounds like that sort of northern part is okay. Is that going to be the new habitability?
Well, there are two ways to deal with these changes in the climate. One is to adapt. see many people will not have the chance of moving. I mean, it's not like a Colombian like me can go and move to Canada. There's just no way they let me cross that border. So right now, given the geopolitical distribution of this planet, most of the world's human population will not be able to move. So these people will have to adapt to whatever is coming to them. I mean, you can imagine, if they had no capacity to adapt, imagine the political instability that that will generate on many of these tropical countries. Some other people, especially the rich countries, they probably will have the chance of moving towards more suitable conditions. So we're talking two potential different responses there. One is adaptation, and the other one is moving. And I think that the developing world is limited on those choices.
One of the other issues that is supposed to arise from climate change pertains to the sea level rises. And so some countries are so close to sea level that there's a concern they may be completely drowned out. Some of them are in the global south, like Tuvalu and Kiribati. What are we facing with these countries?
That is one of the most worrisome consequences of climate change. That's a very good example. See, when we think about climate change, most people often think about just temperature, but there are multiple other related variables that will change as a result of the increasing addition of greenhouse gases. One of them is sea level. Sea level will increase through two different mechanisms. One of them is through the expansion of the water as the oceans get warmer. If you increase the temperature, the water is just going to expand, and that contributes a lot to sea level rise. And the other one is the melting of the sea ice. So those two factors together are going to increase the sea level quite a lot. And for many of places, it's going to be completely devastating, especially those islands that are only 1 or 2 meters above sea level. Entire countries could disappear. However, the impact of this is also going to be seen in developed countries. Right now, for instance, here in the United States, the most expensive houses are often located by the ocean. Here in Hawaii, I mean, a house by the ocean can cost anything between $1 million and $10 million. And it turns out that every time that there is a major flood, all of those houses get inundated with water. So here we are very concerned with sea level rise, especially because those are the most expensive properties right now. So this is a concern, the sea level rise, for many insurance companies nowadays, just because, again, there's just too much money at stake when it comes to sea level rise.
When it comes to issues like biodiversity, you used a phrase, double jeopardy, and you said that has not been really accounted for in previous studies. How does this come into play?
Well, it comes from the sense that species will be impacted through different aspects of the biology of the species will impact those species dramatically. So, for instance, one of them, as I point out to you, is the capacity to move. So many species will not have that chance. So they will be restricted in the way that they can cope with climate change. And the other one is the degree of adaptation. As I point out to you before, one of the problems there is that many species just most likely are not going to have that capacity. They have been living on environments that have been so stable that it's very easy for the climate to exceed what these species can tolerate.
There are other factors such as disease that scientists are saying they're going to spread faster. And that would be another factor that would then add to this sort of double jeopardy factor. How do you see that in the process through the regions that you've studied?
The general goal of the research that we are doing here is on the status of biodiversity. And the main pattern there is that we are losing species like nobody's business. Every year we are driving to extinction on the order of 25,000 species. Every year, we wipe out from the surface of the planet 25,000 species. These are species that you will never see again. Now, why is that happening? So one of the major components of our research is to identify the drivers of that loss. And we, of course, identify climate change as perhaps one of the top drivers of biodiversity loss. But there are multiple other factors at play. We had overexploitation. We had habitat loss. Every year, we are cutting on the order of 10 million hectares of forest. You know, here in Hawaii, as an example, we only left 14% on the native forest. I did have the fortune of living in New Zealand. And for instance, the Northern Island, I mean, it's amazing. I didn't see trees there. You know, every time that I was in New Zealand, I was always wondering how that ecosystem was used to be before. So there are multiple other factors that are impacting these species as well. Now, the concern for me as a scientist is that biodiversity is a very unique attribute of this planet. There is no other planet that we know has life. So it's not like we can go some other planet and replace these species. Once they are gone, they are gone. And it's not like we had the chance of going somewhere else once we screwed up this planet. If we damage this planet, we're going to be stuck with it. So, again, all of these consequences of the way in which we are impacting our planet.
And then losing 25,000 species a year then impacts the remaining species, does it not?
Well, to be honest with you, the situation is so sad that the species, even if some species that have been depleted quite a lot, even if you stop the driver or the decline, some of the species, instead of recovering, they actually keep going down. They kill themselves. It's something that is called ecological suicide. So we had impacted this species so much. At some point, some people recognize that this is happening and they stop doing that thing. But unfortunately, by that time, it's so late that the species itself will drive to extinction. So how this happens? There are three different mechanisms there. One is that the individuals that are left are so few that now they cannot.
We were just talking about the concept of ecological suicide and how that impacts the other species. So can you talk to us again about ecological suicide and its impact?
Yeah, so basically the ecological suicide is the situation in which a species get to be so depleted in which even after you remove a stressor, say that the cause of the decline is overfishing, and somehow a government say we are fishing this species too much, we are going to close these fisheries. What you will expect is that this population will recover. Because you are removing what is making the population sick, you will think that the species will recover. It turns out that it has been found that in many cases, the species, instead of getting better, is actually getting worse. And it triggers a process that is called ecological suicide, in which the species actually drives itself to extinction. There are different mechanisms that have been found to explain this. One is the fact that the individuals that are left are so rare now that they don't find each other. So they cannot reproduce. That is a phenomenon that is called a Lee effect. The other mechanism is through loss of genetic diversity. When you have depleted that population so much, there is not really too much genetic diversity on that population, and a single disturbance that might happen by chance alone can wipe out the species itself. So those are two of the mechanisms that will explain that. And the third mechanism is that since there are so few individuals left, sometimes they start reproducing with each other, like sisters with brothers, brothers with mothers, and all of these things. And that generates a problem that's called inbreeding depression. And that's basically the genetic fallout of reproducing with close relatives. And, of course, that will happen if you only leave a few individuals left in the wild. I mean, there is no other chance than for them to reproduce. So those are some of the mechanisms in which the species will drive to extinction. Now, once the species is gone, there is another fallout from that, which is called co-extinction. And that is that certain cases, many of these species were fundamental for other species. So as soon as this species is gone, all of the species that were dependent on that species are likely to go extinct as well. And that has been documented. There is a couple of papers on that in the journal Nature talking about what they define as co-extinction. That is not that we are causing the extinction of those species, but indirectly they are being driven to extinction by or impact on other species.
Now, your paper looked at these impacts across the world if we left things as the status quo. Is that right?
We actually did two analyses on that paper. We analyzed what will happen if we don't do anything. And what we found is that under those conditions, the climate of the planet could move to a completely new state by sometime by the middle of this century, 2050 plus or minus a few years there. And that could potentially impact 5 billion people. Today, we will have 5 billion people that could be impacted by this climate change if we don't do anything by the year 2050. Now, another scenario that we analyze is, okay, let's see what happens if we take rapid action in reducing the emission of greenhouse gases. This is if we start reducing CO2 emissions by tomorrow. And what we were expecting was to find that the climate will perhaps stabilize, and what we found is that it does not. In fact, all what it does, this massive investment on reducing greenhouse gases, all what it will do is to slow down the change that is to come. And that just to tell you really the sad state of affairs of what we are doing with our planet.
So this is not really reversible at this point. Do you think it's inevitable?
The change in the climate is just not going to be stopped. And that is something that is called the inertia. So imagine, like, for instance, you are driving a car at 100 kilometers per hour and you stop the car. right? You stop the motor. The motor is what is pushing the car, and you will think that the car will stop right away because the motor is not pushing the car anymore. So what happens is that the car will still move a few meters more after you stop the car. That's because of the inertia of the car. It will move the car forward even if there is nothing pushing the car. And that's what will happen with the climate as well. So even if we stop climate change today, this climate change is most likely going to keep going for a while. How far? Well, that's unfortunately something that we just don't know yet. But, do you really want to find that out later? This is just one of the decisions that we are faced with today. Is that, in my opinion, I don't think we should test any of these theories. We just don't mess with the climate.
One of the things that you mentioned to me was that you come from a farming family, and that's one of the issues that you also looked at was food and food production and what's going to happen in terms of feeding a planet under these conditions. What do you expect?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the other situation as well, is that most of the action to reduce greenhouse gases has to come from the first world. And unfortunately, we are the people that is perhaps going to be the less impacted by this and that will have the most capacity to adapt to these changes. However, what is happening is that we are leaving half of the world's human population at danger from this situation. And unfortunately, since we are not connected, that doesn't mean anything to us. But for people in the first world, we're talking about their livelihoods, their jobs, their food. Unfortunately, I don't think we had that kind of awareness yet. And even among the scientists, you know, we sometimes find these massive discoveries that really are impacting the planet. And I don't think that means much even for some of us as a scientist. I think that really for you to get a feeling of this, you need to go and live on the places that are being impacted right now for climate change. And I'm telling you that you will change your mind about how serious this is.
Camilo Mora, I would like to thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
It is my pleasure. Thank you very much, Maria, for inviting me.
When we come back, the world of migration and the systems and policies that perpetuate many of the inhumane conditions. Stay tuned.
It's great to be in America. Ain't no lion or tiger, ain't no mamba snake. Just a sweet watermelon and a buckwheat cake. Everybody is as happy as a man can be. Climb aboard, little wog, sail away with me. Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay. Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay.
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. What is fueling mass migration, and how can the U.S. and the international community humanely solve the underlying problems? Three experts join us. Kevin Johnson is dean and professor of public interest law at the University of California Davis School of Law. He is the author of Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border and co-author of Opening the Floodgates, Why America Needs to Rethink Its Borders and Immigration Laws. David Shirk is a professor of political science and international relations and the director of the Justice in Mexico Project at the University of San Diego. He has co-authored Drug Violence in Mexico, Data and Analysis Through 2013, Armed with Impunity, Curbing Military Human Rights Abuses in Mexico, and Contemporary Mexican Politics. David Kyle also joins us. David Kyle is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. His publications include Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives, and Transnational Peasants, Migration Networks and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you with us. What I'd like to start with is the motivation for migrants to upend their lives and migrate, given that some of them will face and do face very serious dangers. David Kyle, this is something that you've studied. What have you found?
Well, I found that people don't take this decision very lightly. Don't think that that should be any news, but most of the time there isn't just one factor or one dimension of why they might be leaving. There's usually a number of factors, both in the sending region and sometimes also strong attractions to the destination, often actual recruiters going into a region and actually trying to recruit them for jobs abroad. So often we see a number of factors at play.
When you say recruiters, do you mean corporations from developed countries?
Sometimes it's corporate recruiters. And historically, in certain regions of, for example, Mexico, there were actual recruiters starting in the 20s and 30s who were recruiting migrants to go north to factories in the northern United States. Some of those are the same communities that have sent migrants for decades. And so it starts a sort of social network, snowball effect across generations. Today, that's more likely to be played by third-party intermediaries of what we call a migration industry. So people who profit from the brokering and recruitment, often paid by the migrants themselves.
So these are the smugglers that you studied in your other book, people who, it's kind of an underground thing.
That's true, but a lot of the activities are not really entirely underground or illegal. Migration industry includes a wide range of people making money through both licit and illicit activities, so transportation, communication. Many of the activities that they do are not illegal in the sending country and are often promoted as something very important to the sending country because of the large sums of remittances that are sent back to the sending country.
In one of your books, I saw a number that you had retrieved from the United Nations. There were something like 50 million migrants of irregular status. What is that?
These are migrants who are traveling in some form that has not been completely sanctioned by a state. That's the broad definition.
One of the things that triggered this particular panel was we had interviewed a journalist who followed migrants from Central America through Mexico to try to get into the United States. And while they were going through certain parts of Mexico, they were facing Los Zetas most of the time, the drug cartel, which would kidnap them 100 at a time, 200 at a time in broad daylight, and either make a lot of money by asking for a ransom from their relatives, or enslaving in some cases, or trafficking them in some cases, or just disappearing them. Is this a common story?
This is David Shirk responding to the question, and I would say it is all too common. I wouldn't say it is the predominant story of migrants coming to the United States. It may be the predominant story of migrants coming to the United States through Mexico from Central America, insofar as there's the gauntlet that Central American migrants have to navigate in order to get to the United States is not just crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, which is itself fraught with many challenges, but also navigating from the Guatemalan-Mexican border to the Texas-Mexico border or any other portion of the border. There are a number of hazards that migrants face, including corrupt authorities at the federal and local level, transnational and local gangs and organized crime groups, including the Zetas, not limited to the Zetas. Also physical hazards, the challenges of physically being transported from the southern Mexican border up into our border and across it involves many life-threatening physical hazards, whether you're talking about the trains that migrants climb upon in the dead of night and hold on to, at risk of death or loss of limb if they should fall off, to, you know, the physical challenges of getting across the U.S. border and, you know, possibly being shot or harmed by a Border Patrol agent and the dangers that they put themselves in the hands of smugglers. And if they're on their own, you know, crawling through the desert day or night, they're exposed to extreme elements. They run into deadly animals and dangerous animals like rattlesnakes. So really, we're talking about a range of challenges that migrants face. And in many cases, even if they pay thousands of dollars to get safe transit to the United States, they're confronted at some point or another by these kinds of challenges.
Kevin Johnson.
I think that the speakers have it exactly right. the journey to the United States through Mexico is dangerous, both for Mexicans and even more so perhaps for Central Americans. The dangers run the gamut from criminal elements to the conditions, and things don't get much better in some respects once they get to the United States, where they're subject to exploitation in the workplace and other mistreatment.
And is there anything else you'd like to add on to this, David Kyle?
I want to emphasize the point about safe houses, that in the media it's almost always constructed as a criminal syndicate holding them for ransom. But often the so-called safe houses are actually safe houses in which the migrants are waiting for their family members here to pay the smuggling fees, and that was within the arrangement that they made with the smuggler. I would add that the migrants are traveling in a way that does not allow them to step forward to the law enforcement locally or at the destination. And so they're really completely at the mercy of these syndicates and criminal gangs that often hold them for ransom.
Now, do we have any types of numbers about what percentage of migrants survive this trek? David Shirk?
First of all, we don't have very good numbers on the size of the undocumented or the irregular migrant populations. So I don't think we have rock solid numbers, but I do think that we're talking about tens of thousands of people who are exposed to these risks. We know, for example, that just in terms of trying to measure the number of migrants that fall victim to organized crime, we know that hundreds, if not thousands, have been killed in recent years by the body count of mass graves in Mexico, in particularly northeastern Mexico. It's reasonable to use those kinds of figures. But it really puts an important point here, which is all migrants are vulnerable to exploitation, and especially all undocumented immigrant people who are moving through any country without proper legal documentation, who have what we would call irregular status. So those groups are especially vulnerable for the reasons that have been mentioned. So it doesn't just stop with trafficking organizations, although that has become a mini industry for certain organized crime groups like the Zetas.
I think both you, David Shirk, and I think also David Kyle talked about some of the factors that are actually leading to some trends that are particularly scary. One is the idea of erecting these really strong borders that make it so that migrants do have to rely on either smugglers or other people who will get them through. So it has given rise to this. David Kyle, why don't we go back to you on this?
Well, much like Prohibition in the 1920s, when you have a flow that is completely normalized and, as I said, recruited over decades, and then all of a sudden we erect very hard barriers and enforcement programs, it was not surprising that people would continue to migrate. There are still jobs on the side of the border. They often do not hire the smuggler until they have the job on this side of the border. The culture of migration, but also the global culture and narrative around global capitalism that says you need to go global, you need to think about not only your local region, but other regions, not to mention the cultural production in places like California that produce movies and other media that show the lifestyle that we lead here. So you kind of combine that with, on the other hand, for many people around the world, especially in South America and Central America, leaving home and or innovating and developing in their home region is not as easy as what the images may portray and the kinds of lifestyle that they see and would like to have themselves.
David Shirk?
I think that the hardening of the border has, without doubt, been the primary cause of the development of organized crime and the increased sophistication of organized crime in Mexico, both with regard to the drug trade and with regard to undocumented immigration. 30 years ago, you didn't need a smuggler or a coyote to get you across the border. You could very easily walk across the border in many sections by yourself or with someone who had a little bit of experience. And by making it much more difficult, by creating this prohibition regime, as David Kyle was suggesting, we've essentially created a black market for labor. There's a certain profit that can be obtained as a result of that black market. and criminal enterprises have moved in, and it creates a problem for law enforcement, that law enforcement creates a problem that it now has to confront. And it's also a problem for the migrants, because these are essentially predatory organizations. And what's, I think, particularly worrying is that we've seen organized crime groups that are involved in people smuggling also venture into now other areas, including human trafficking, as you've described, sort of blanket term for basically exploiting people who are in transit, and also other kinds of sort of criminal entities. So I think that the key challenge that we face at the border is, how do we get people out of the shadows? How do we regularize flows so that we reduce the profitability of people smuggling, and also give the migrants themselves recourse to talk to law enforcement, to be part of the formal economy, and to basically be better contributors to the economic activities that they are already engaged in.
Kevin Johnson, you've looked at this in terms of the legal aspects of the U.S. and the policy aspects of the U.S. What do you think we should learn from the long arc of history with the U.S. law and policy and immigrants?
I think one of the things that we have to learn and we need to act upon is the fact that what is going on here, no small part, is a labor migration. And historically, it's been a labor migration, and it's not exclusively a labor migration. There are family and other networks that contribute to immigration. But we can't just stop the demand for migrating to the United States by building fences, putting more boots on the ground, as the president would say, or having drones fly across the border. The very important point that you made is that more enforcement has had some collateral impacts that deserve certain attention. One of them is that before the border operations of the 1990s, smuggling fees were relatively small, maybe a few hundred dollars to get across south of San Diego. Now there are thousands of dollars to get across. That's brought in some of the criminal networks that have been talked about, and that's had negative collateral consequences on the migrants. At the same time, the enforcement measures in San Diego and El Paso, for example, have funneled migrants into more dangerous, more isolated location where they're more subject to the elements, more subject to criminal conduct, and more likely to die. So we have a system now where smugglers are charging large fees, people are dying by the day, and at the same time, we're not having much of an impact on our undocumented immigrant population in the United States. Basically, the population today is best estimated about 11 million people. It changed a little bit with the recession beginning in 2008, but really hasn't changed much, even though we've increased enforcement by millions of dollars a year, deportations by hundreds of thousands a year. And so I think we have to think very carefully in terms of future immigration reform, what we can do to regularize migration flows from countries where there's labor that wants to migrate, and if that labor gets here, employers will employ that labor. So to me, what we have to learn is that our immigration laws can't ignore what's going on in the rest of the world, can't ignore the demand for labor in the United States, and can't simply try to seal off this nation from what's going on globally.
One of the other things that I saw in your writing, Kevin Johnson, dealt with the law in the context of our civil rights history. How would you describe that for us to understand?
Historically, immigration law has enforced racial and other boundaries in the United States. You can look through the history of the immigration laws and see who the demons of every particular era was. You could see a time when, you know, the Irish were excluded, when the Chinese were excluded, when other Asian groups were excluded. Now you see a time where Mexicans, in no small part, are excluded. I do think that it's too frequent the case that immigration law and enforcement in these times is discussed as if it were isolated and separate from race. But we know, as a nation, which groups are most dramatically affected by immigration law and enforcement, and so do those groups. They know that as well. And if you look at our deportation numbers, you look at the focus along the U.S.-Mexico border in particular, you can make a colorable argument that our laws are designed primarily to keep Mexicans out of the United States. So I do think that these issues need to be discussed. But historically, we have used the immigration laws to keep out the people we don't want in this country, whether it be homosexuals, whether it be criminals, whether it be racial minorities, whether it be poor people or people with moderate income. We have a very rich, if not unfortunate, history of that.
Let me just remind listeners now that they're listening to the Scholar Circle, and we're speaking with Kevin Johnson, David Kyle, and David Shirk about issues of migration and immigration and the dynamics of that globally. Let's bring David Kyle back in. What would you add to this?
Well, I want to go back to a point that was made earlier about the rise of criminal syndicates and the prices of smugglers, that there's a direct connection to that, and emphasize that 20, 30 years ago, there were practically no real criminal syndicates involved directly in the smuggling part of the business. The reason for that is that the migrants also have to trust the smuggler, and the smuggler has to trust the migrants, and that generally migrants paid on credit. So you pay after arrival. And so there's a sort of loan involved, sometimes directly by the smugglers, sometimes by a third party. Sometimes they are kind of loan sharks, but be that as it may, it got them across the border. Often guarantees were part of the deal. One of the interesting things about that is around the world, we tend to see the same guarantee of three times, that the smuggler will try three times. If you're caught twice, you go back and try again without any additional cost. However, as the border has gotten more difficult, smuggling fees have gone up. It's only in the last 5 to 10 years that, because of the attraction of the huge profits that can now be made because of that fact, criminal syndicates have started to get into the business directly, especially in Mexico. But this is a relatively recent development.
One of the journalists that we interviewed talked about how much money is made in the ransom process and how that has become a huge business. Has anybody documented that? Do you know David Shirk?
I haven't seen scholarship or efforts to try to tally the profits that are made. I think there are good efforts, for example, at the University of California, San Diego, to track the fees that are paid by migrants. But looking at profit margins and how the business side of migrant smuggling works, I think is not something that has been.
Well, and this journalist was speaking particularly about the ransoms that the cartels or the other organized crime groups collect after abducting.
And I think that's really poorly understood. You can look at a lot of the rhetoric that came out over the last couple of years about how those ransoms have worked. In Phoenix, which is a major corridor, Arizona, as a major corridor for migration flows, the local law enforcement of Phoenix and other parts of the state have tried to suggest that Phoenix and other parts of Arizona are the kidnapping capital of the United States, and they really place this great emphasis on the threat that results from cartel activity. And what they're really doing is kind of conflating the kinds of ransoms that you're describing with the problem of migrant smuggling and how people are being held for to pay off their fees or additional fees that are imposed. And I think that that phenomenon hasn't been well studied, and it's also been significantly distorted by law enforcement officials who have an agenda to boost their budgets and get national attention from Congress to deal with problems that they've conflated. So, I think you're right that it's not something that's well examined.
Well, let's turn to some solutions. Like, where should the U.S. go from this point? And where should we go internationally to deal with this, kind of inhumane problem that we're facing really all over the world? And perhaps, Kevin Johnson, we should start with you with the law and public policy.
Well, my view is that we really need to think seriously as a nation about some meaningful immigration reform that deals with labor migration and allows for low and medium skilled workers to migrate lawfully to the United States. Where the smuggling and criminal networks come into play is when there's no legal way for otherwise law-abiding people to come to the United States. And I do fear that the discussion of cartels and the criminal element may lead some to believe that the migrants themselves are criminals, when for the most part we know that they come here to work and not necessarily to be engaged in any criminal activities, even though their entry may be done unlawfully. But in my estimation, what needs to be done, and it hasn't been done in the last 100 years of American immigration law, is to look carefully about the supply and demand of labor and pay some attention to that economic reality in fashioning a law that allows for realistic immigration and doesn't require unrealistic enforcement that leads to the kinds of problems we have today.
David Kyle?
I agree. Originally, the North American Free Trade Agreement, known as NAFTA, had the free flow of people as well. And that part of the policy was taken out relatively at the last minute. I think that's probably unrealistic to have a sort of free trade area or harmonizing our economies and to some extent even our polities, but not really allowing for the free flow of people, especially people seeking jobs.
And David Shirk, you've actually testified about this and done cost-benefit analysis. What would you say?
No, I think that's absolutely the case. There's a fairly broad consensus among experts on immigration that the flows of migrants into the country, if the flows of migrants into the country were regularized, you would not have to worry about border security. And in many ways, certain interests in Congress and certain voices around the country have advocated for putting the cart before the horse, building fences before regularizing flows. And that is really something that I think exacerbates the problem. It makes it seem like the border's out of control and that we will never get it under control. But the minute that we make some kind of serious and comprehensive reform of our immigration system to allow people to come here legally for whom there is work and for whom there are real opportunities, the problems that we have at the border, at least with regard to immigration, I think will largely go away.
Finally, when you look at Washington and Kevin Johnson, I think you had been critical of our president, President Obama, and his approach. And you've also been critical of people who, such as Sam Huntington, who have expressed concern about national identity. What do you think are the problems with these responses?
In terms of the Obama administration, I guess I would point to the fact that well, some kind of immigration reform has been promised. What we've primarily seen in this administration is increasing deportations over time. And this president has deported more non-citizens than any president in the United States history, and currently is deporting about 400,000 people a year. Now, there are promises that there's going to be some, and there have been some marginal improvements in immigration enforcement and in the treatment of immigrants. But we've been waiting quite a long time for some kind of meaningful change to the immigration laws. And I know it's in the Congress's court, but there has to be some bigger push, and there currently is quite a push in Washington, D.C. for immigration reform. But to me, what you see out of the Obama administration is more and more deportation, more and more promises, but not more and more meaningful reform. In terms of the Samuel Huntingtons of the world, I do think it's important for us to have a discussion about national identity and what this country is. But at the same time, what I'm averse to is people like Samuel Huntington saying what the national identity is and shouldn't be, which in his views, in Anglo-Saxon nation, a non-Catholic nation, and a non-Hispanic nation. So I'm not against having a dialogue about identity, but I am against trying to impose one on the nation as a whole. And I think that that's the kind of discussion we should have as a country, but not being having one imposed from the outside.
And final words, David Kyle?
I believe we only have to look at Silicon Valley here in Northern California to see how the diversity of that region by especially the flow of immigrants and the human capital and creativity and imagination that they bring, the different ideas from around the world, has contributed so much to the success of Silicon Valley, to point to how, yes, identity is important, But it's in this combination that really is the key feature of the American experience about creative change and how we see ourselves moving forward.
And David Shirk.
Yeah, and to reiterate that point from a Southern California perspective, I think one of the best immigration protest signs that I've seen at rallies and protests is no Mexicans, no burritos. if you don't let the people in, you don't get to experience the benefits that we have always enjoyed as a nation of immigrants. And I think that's going back to the earlier point. That is Samuel Huntington's great mistake. He wants to take an 1820s view of what the United States is. And that what's brilliant to me about the idea of America is that it is the idea and one of the only countries in the world that is founded on the idea that it is a place for all people to come and make into a great nation.
Well, that's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you to all three of you for joining us here on the Scholar Circle and sharing your thoughts and your research with us. Kevin Johnson, David Kyle, David Shirk, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Johnson is Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law at the University of California Davis School of Law. He is the author of Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border and co-author of Opening the Floodgates, Why America Needs to Rethink Its Borders and Immigration Laws. David Shirk is a professor of political science and international relations and the director of the Justice in Mexico Project at the University of San Diego. He has co-authored Drug Violence in Mexico, Data and Analysis Through 2013, Armed with Impunity, Curbing Military Human Rights Abuses in Mexico, and Contemporary Mexican Politics. David Kyle is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. His publications include Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives, and Transnational Peasants, Migration Networks and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Cuauhtemoc Gailaman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay. Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay.